I'm Eric Parker, and this is Inter Alia. My guest today is a superhero. She doesn't wear a cape, doesn't leap tall buildings or bend steel with her bare hands, but she does, from time to time, save the world. Or at least the worlds of those who've been convicted of a crime they did not commit. And in classic superhero fashion, she does it with a staff of just two people, made possible by the countless hours of volunteer attorneys who devote their valuable time to the mission of freeing, and perhaps more importantly, vindicating the innocent. Radha Natarajan was born in the United States to Indian parents who immigrated to America in search of a better life. Their hard work, according to Radha, was singular in purpose: to earn money which they could send back to India to support their families there. Her parents' hard work also provided Radha with, as she describes it, the privilege of avoiding student debt, a privilege, she told me, that allowed her to devote her professional life to a legal practice that does not come with the kind of salary typically paid to graduates of Stanford University and NYU Law School. After 12 years as a highly accomplished public defender, Radha joined the New England Innocence Project as its executive director, bringing her litigation skills, compassion, and a fierce determination to bringing an end to wrongful convictions. Nationally recognized as an expert in eyewitness identification, Radha applies the lessons learned in the reform of eyewitness identification to other flawed applications of forensic science. She sat down with me to discuss the New England Innocence Project and what led her to forego big law and the money that goes with it in exchange for the rewards she receives from freeing the innocent from prison. Radha Natarajan, thanks for sitting down with me today. With all the convicted felons out there, how do you and your staff decide who gets a shot at your services?
Identifying the innocent is a really complicated and sophisticated enterprise. It's something that our staff has expertise in, and the way that we go about screening for innocence is something that we've built over time. We look at cases of exonerations in the past in order to identify the causes of wrongful conviction so that we can look for those red flags in the cases that we get.
Can you give us a sense of what the formula is?
So there's not really a statistical formula, and part of the reason is that there's a lot of missing information. What we know is that from the exonerations that we do know about, there are categories of people and categories of causes. So for example, we know about mistaken eyewitness identifications. We know that false confessions lead to wrongful convictions. We know that false informants, we know that jailhouse informants that have given false testimony, that leads to wrongful convictions. We know that flawed forensic science, whether that's because of misconduct, whether that's because of science that was not vetted properly, so whether that was, you know, unreliable science, or whether that's science that has evolved, for whatever reason, that science led to a wrongful conviction. So these are some categories of cases that we know has led to wrongful convictions. But at the same time, we also know that there are other things such as bias in the system. We know that, for example, racism is something that has led to people being suspected of things, and then that bias leads to, it could lead to a mistaken eyewitness identification. It could lead to pressure being put on someone in the interrogation room. It could lead to someone feeling pressure to just to snitch on somebody else. It could lead to a number of different things. And so there's forces, societal forces. And it's not that one of these factors acts on its own. It could be that all of these factors all together work together. And so we know of some of these factors, and there's probably a number of other factors that we don't know about. And so each application, we don't look at it as a formula. We identify these red flags, but we look at each of these individually, and then we read each person's story very, very carefully. And just to give you a sense, you know, we take each person's application very, very seriously. Sometimes it takes years to screen an individual case before we even decide whether to accept it. And that's because we want to make sure that we're giving the person as much time as we should to make sure that we're, you know, really identifying whether or not the person, you know, should, whether or not we can help them.
Do you think there's any bias built into the New England Innocence Project's view? And I don't mean it in a corrupt way. I mean it almost in terms of the lens through which they look at these cases.
There is no human system to which there is no bias. And so absolutely, whether or not, so yes, absolutely, you know, whether the New England Innocence Project is screening cases, whether a prosecutor's conviction integrity unit is screening cases, whether another innocence organization is screening cases, whether it, no matter what, if it's a human enterprise, it is going to involve bias. So yes.
Yep. So I guess my next question is, have you been duped, played, lied to?
I don't know the answer to that question. What I can tell you is that I think that because of the extremely limited resources we have, I think that unfortunately we err on the other side in that we screen so carefully that I think that we unfortunately miss a lot of people who are probably innocent. I mean, I think the reality of it is that there are people who are innocent that we can't help. It's not when we reject cases, it's not because we think they're not innocent. Oftentimes it's because even though they may be innocent, it's because we don't see a path forward. And that's because the way that our criminal legal system is structured is that there's only certain legal mechanisms that we can help people. And that's one of the things that we have to look for. So while I will not say that we haven't been so-called duped, what I will say is that our vetting process is so incredibly severe that I think it's unlikely that that's happened. Certainly not, there's no case that comes to mind where I would say that that has happened.
So then it comes a point after all this vetting and screening and meticulous analysis of the evidence where you say to yourself, this is a candidate for the New England Innocence Project, correct?
Correct.
So then I imagine there's a moment where two big things occur. One is where the district attorney or the assistant district attorney who prosecuted the case is advised that what they thought of as being tied and on the shelf is back down on the table to be exhumed and reevaluated, which can't be a DA's favorite moment. That's number one. And the second moment, which I want to talk to you about in a second, is the family or the victim themselves who has to come to terms with the fact that not only has a scab been picked wide open, but they don't understand where you're coming from. So let me start first with the families. What's that been like? And I'm sure it's an emotional moment for you.
We're really cognizant of the fact that when there was a wrongful conviction, there are many victims. So one of the victims is the person who was wrongfully convicted, and those are our clients. Another victim is if it was a crime that involved a victim, you know, whether it was a murder and it's the person's family or the person who died, whether it was a robbery, whether it was a rape, you know, whatever it may be, there are victims that were involved in that crime. There are also crimes, well, there were also convictions for which no crime happened, but we're not talking about that category of cases. But for crimes where there was a victim and the wrong person was convicted, those folks are victimized twice because they believed incorrectly that the person was actually caught and they felt a false sense of security. And for a long time, you know, they felt that justice was done. And then all of a sudden they feel that they may feel many, many things. And we're very sensitive about that. I think that, first of all, it's important to be sensitive about that, but also that, you know, we're not suggesting that we're not antagonistic to that. We actually want justice for those victims, but not at the expense of somebody who is innocent. And frankly, I think that victims understand that too. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that our interests are actually at odds with that. And I will tell you that there are many exoneration cases where the actual perpetrator went on to victimize more people. And so there's a third victim that we're not talking about, which is society, where the people who went free, because the person who was the actual perpetrator went on to commit more crimes, then victimized more people. And so our concern also is public safety. And I think that, you know, frankly, I think most people would agree that innocent people shouldn't be in prison, and that if someone should be in prison for a crime, it should be the person who committed the crime. So I think that, you know, there are many interests. There are many people who together have these interests in mind, and they're aligned.
Which makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I can't imagine you sitting down with a victim and saying, would you be satisfied knowing that the wrong person is sitting in a jail cell and the right person who should be in that jail cell is out there potentially harming another person? That, on a certain level, that makes perfect sense to me, and I would think any victim would agree. At the same time, though, I would imagine that closure, the psychological need for closure and the human tendency to say, listen, we got the right guy, and it's people like you, and you know what a fan of yours I am, so that's parenthetical. But you know where I'm coming from, that people like you are sending in guilty people who've already been tried by a jury of their peers back out onto the streets where police officers and detectives have risked their lives, for example, to get these guys. We had a full-blown jury trial. We had the appeals process. He went away, and now you're trying to undo this because you just don't believe in the death penalty, or you don't believe in life without possibility of parole and so forth. It becomes an ideological war. And I'm curious as to whether or not you've had to have that level of conversation with people that goes beyond simply, don't you want the right guy in the jail cell?
There are a lot of psychological factors that are involved in these cases that are very, very complicated. I think you're right that for victims, they want closure. In addition, when you have, for example, an eyewitness identification case, I think many victims feel that they made a mistake and therefore they feel guilty, even though we know that it's not their fault. And so there's a desire not to believe that they made a mistake. So there's this guilt also because they feel that they themselves personally put somebody in prison who is innocent, even though we know psychologically it's actually not, because of the science, we know it's actually not their fault that these things happen, because the human brain is not perfect, right? We also know that, police officers and prosecutors and judges, their identity is built on doing justice. And therefore, they don't want to believe that, and public defenders and defense attorneys, their identity is built on this. And so they don't want to believe that they participated in a wrongful conviction. And so all of these people whose identity is built on that, they don't want to believe that they ever participated. And so they become immediately defensive.
Those are your headwinds.
Yes. And so we engage in that all the time. And I think that, first of all, it is our job to understand that we're going to face that resistance. We face it all the time. Number two, it's our job to educate. Number three, we understand that when we are dealing with a wrongful conviction, we better have the proof that when we are bringing a innocence case, that we better have the evidence, that, we have to demonstrate not only that, justice wasn't done, which is the standard in Massachusetts, although, we work throughout New England, and there are different standards in other jurisdictions, but that justice wasn't done. But frankly, I think that society wants us to prove something more than that, and I think we take that seriously.
Putting aside for a second the incredibly detailed vetting process, is there still a hierarchical model that you follow? For example, does somebody serving life trump somebody who is doing 10 years, even though the one who's doing 10 years might have more glaring evidence of innocence? And you could reduce this down to somebody doing 6 months to a year. I assume you have to allocate resources to where the greatest harm is being suffered. Is that fair?
Yeah, resource allocation is a really difficult problem with a small nonprofit. So we're always looking to figure out how to do that. So certainly one of the things we look at is how long the sentence is that the person is serving. And so we will prioritize that. So for example, there are people who are out of custody. They still have convictions and they're still suffering consequences. For example, if they were convicted of a sexual assault for which they're claiming innocence, and they're still having to register as a sex offender, that is a serious sure consequence is on their liberty.
Yep.
And we're not unsympathetic to that. On the other hand, we have, you know, folks who are still incarcerated, and so we will prioritize someone whose liberty is still at stake.
So I would imagine then that there must be moments where a convicted felon reaches out to you for help and you have to say no because of limited resources. Can you think of an instance where that occurred and it just tore you up because you couldn't help them?
Off the top of my head, I mean, I can think of, right now I'm thinking about one case where it's not necessarily because of resources, but because we couldn't see a path forward, and it definitely tears me up. It's a case where it was a sexual assault case where there was exculpatory DNA, which indicated that the person, based on the story, could not have been guilty. But that evidence was presented to the jury, and the jury found him guilty. And so the question for us has to be, you know, is there anything new that we can do? And the problem is that all the evidence of innocence was already presented to a jury. So there's clear evidence of innocence, but the evidence was already tested. What can we do?
So that's
we don't want to reject that case.
Sure.
But we don't know what we can do. And so if anything new, you know, if there's any new avenues of investigation that we think about over time, you know, the applicant flags for us later, that's a case we might revisit. But at the moment, we had to reject it.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the makeup of the New England Innocence Project is like?
Right now, it's comprised of me, so I'm the executive director. I have a wonderful staff attorney, Laura Carey, and we have a wonderful case director, Liz Regan. So that is the New England Innocence Project. As far as the full-time staff, we are fortunate enough to have legal interns, intake interns. We partner with law firms in Boston as well as in New Hampshire right now. We partner with other network attorneys in other places, including in Rhode Island and in Maine. And we're working on increasing those partnerships. So we have to increase our capacity through our pro bono relationships.
You are a graduate of Stanford University, is that right?
Undergraduate, yes.
You went on to NYU Law School in New York, a top 10 law school.
Correct.
And would it be fair to say that your income is not necessarily on par with what we might find at a major Boston or New York City law firm in a lawyer with your degree of experience? Is that a fair statement?
Very fair.
So you're not in this for the money. Is that also a fair statement? What leads someone to pursue this kind of work with such grueling hours and such an emotionally taxing component to it for money that I don't think too many people would feel is fair given the work?
It seems strange to say, but I think, you know, I really didn't think about the money. And I think that that has to be on its own, you know, a result of some privilege, right? You know, my parents are both immigrants, and, you know, when they came to this country, they had to think about money a lot because they didn't have any money. And in fact, my father, the entire purpose of moving to this country and leaving his entire family behind was to make money to send back to his very poor family in India. So money was what they thought about. That's all they thought about. Like, a job was about making money.
As sustenance. Not luxury. As sustenance.
That was it. That was the purpose of getting a job. And so they had to have a, you know, well-paid job. And you know, they had to, if they were given the opportunity for a better paying job, they would take that, even if it meant moving away from the family. I remember my father, you know, at different points in my life, you know, left the home for, you know, sometimes years at a time in order to make more money, because that's how, you know, that's how he thought of a job, right? And my mother, both who, you know, worked all the time, you know, supported my sister and I, and also sent money back home to India and supported their families back home. And as a result of being supported financially and in other ways by my parents, it was possible for me to not have to think about that. From a very young age, I felt very marginalized. And that feeling of marginalization and isolation was very obviously hurtful, but also an important understanding. Number one, I think it really helped me develop a sense of independence and also, you know, to understand, you know, who I am and develop a sense of self and a sense of confidence and a sense of identity, and also sort of double down in my own identity. Could have gone a different way, of course. But I think also it made me understand, you know, what it feels like to not be accepted, to be different, to be, you know, ostracized, to be isolated, you know, all of these feelings. And I think that those feelings are accompanied with a lot of different things.
So it has, the bias is the root.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, that's a thread for sure. The impact of racism, I think, is something that is a common thread throughout my life. And, you know, when I went to Stanford, what I studied is race in the legal system. And so there's no surprise there. And then going into being a public defender and doing this work, I mean, that is a common thread. Is the impact of race in all of these things. And that has certainly played a role, of course. And you can't talk about the criminal legal system without talking about race. And something that I inherently understood, given where I grew up and how that impacted my life in so many very, very basic ways as a child.
And even by anybody's standard in terms of an experience as an undergraduate, you didn't just study this. You had quite an exceptional experience while you were a Stanford undergrad. You were introduced to and became an intern for and ultimately the mentee of a very celebrated civil rights attorney, Joaquim Avila. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his impact on your choices?
Joaquin was a voting rights attorney in California. And I mean, at the time, I didn't know what a voting rights attorney was. I think many folks now think do, but he was one of the very few voting rights attorneys who worked on his own and not with, you know, an organization. And he brought lawsuits on behalf of cities where he felt that Latino voters were marginalized as a result of the way lines were drawn, district lines were drawn. And he brought those lawsuits on behalf of those voters so that they could get basic things like streetlights and basic, you know, and just, you know, the right to have a voice in their communities. And I started working with him as a first year in college and worked with him for many years. And he unfortunately passed away this year. And everything that he was and what he did, I think, really taught me everything there is to know that I know about being a lawyer. His attention to detail, his passion, working with experts. When I worked with him, we went to the United States Supreme Court.
That was just incredible. You went along with him to argue before the United States Supreme Court in a celebrated voting rights case as a sophomore at Stanford. Is that right?
That's right.
What was that like?
It was incredible. I mean, I don't know that I even realized how significant that was then, as I do now. His meticulous preparation, but also his humor. And I just remember, you know, I learned about appellate advocacy when I was in college, you know, through that experience. It was just incredible. So, but, you know, so the work that he did was incredibly detail-oriented, but everything that we did, he always brought it back to the impact that it had on people. And so that really stuck with me. He was such a great teacher and such a great mentor to so many people, and I was just lucky enough.
He just recently passed.
He did.
Yeah. I know that was a big loss to you and to everyone who practices in that area.
Yes.
It's too bad.
And it's terrible that, you know, we have to have this conversation where, you know, it's really confounding to you that, you know, someone can make a choice to do the kind of work that I'm doing, which is, you know, really important and actually
no doubt
so fulfilling, not just important, but it's actually it's incredibly fulfilling for me to do it. But that, you know, this personal sacrifice, as you see it, right? It's certainly a financial sacrifice. There's no question about it. But that the scale is so incredibly different if I had chosen one path versus the path that I did choose. That disparity in the law, you know, between, for example, becoming a, you know, assistant district attorney or, you know, becoming a, you know, associate at a law firm in Boston. Forget New York.
New York. But I get your point.
It's pretty troubling, and we're certainly not going to resolve that either. But I think, that's a pretty difficult position for law students to be in, and it's not, that's pretty frustrating. But I will tell you that, you know, despite the low-paying nature of those jobs, you know, I think the quality of the lawyering in those jobs is quite high on both sides. It's actually, maybe that's why, unfortunately, they continue to be funded at those levels, which is terrible and completely unfair, but it hasn't affected the quality.
So I guess I'd like to conclude by asking you a question, which is very personal, I guess, in nature, but is the counterpoint to the sacrifices you've made in terms of salary and other benefits. And that is, can you describe for us the endorphins that are released when an innocent man or woman is released from prison for a crime they did not commit?
It's a really, really hard thing because it is incredible for someone to gain their freedom, but it's also incredibly scary, which you may not have predicted. When someone is released on parole or probation, there's actually some supports, surprisingly. When someone is exonerated, there is nothing. They sometimes, you don't even know, like the court makes a decision sometimes that you can't even anticipate when they're going to make this decision. And so, for example, I have a client right now who in October will have been in prison for 35 years. I am hopeful that in the next year he will be released. I don't know when that will happen, but when it happens, that transition from inside to outside, I mean, it will be incredible and he deserves his freedom. But it's also going to be very scary because in the time that he's been in prison, his entire family that he knew has passed away. Wow. So who is going to be supporting him, right? These are very scary questions. There is no support system that exists for exonerees to come out to. There's no place to go for people to get their IDs. There's no place to teach them how to deal with the technology changes that have happened in the last 35 years. There's nothing. And so this is a very, very scary, scary place. And so on the one hand, it's incredible. And you're right. It's, you know, it's exhilarating. It's amazing. There's nothing more wonderful than having your freedom. And he deserves that. It's also, it doesn't end there. There's really a lot of support that that needs to happen. When our client, Fred Weichel, was released last year after 36 years in prison, you know, we're talking, you know, he did get a cell phone and once he, you know, learned how to use it, you know, we were on the phone every day talking about, you know, what is that like? Every single day, you know, that freedom, like, but different things. It's like, because every day it's something different and sort of just getting used to not being in prison. It's quite complicated.
I want to ask you one question that I'm not even sure it's a fair question to answer, but get your take on it. We have a president right now who has not done a whole lot to shore up an appreciation for our justice system, who in many ways has undermined people's faith in it and so forth. And I'm wondering, has that made your job harder?
I think that there's been a renewed interest in the last year and a half for people to look at freedom and justice in a different way. I think people are paying attention more to their right, to other people's rights, to the impact of racism and to bias. I think that many people are being drawn into the impact that these things are happening. I think that people see that it's affecting so many people. And I think that people are paying attention. And I think that's a really good thing. And so I'm hopeful that the more conversations and that the more attention is going to have people care more about the criminal legal system, about wrongful convictions, about all of these things. And so I think that there are more conversations, and I think that's important.
Radha Natarajan, thanks for sitting down with me today. I really appreciate it. And thanks for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Eric.
Inter Alia is a production of Roll Saber Media, with production support provided by Mage Consulting, LLC, and Radio Entrepreneurs. Our producer is Alex Cooper. Our sound engineer is Chris Jarrell. To listen to more episodes of Inter Alia, visit rollsaber.com. That's R-O-L-L-S-A-B-R-E.com.